I would argue that the very fact that you're doing those things at all is actually proof that A, you're alive, and B, you're trying to heal.
People think they need motivation to drink less, to stop smoking, to exercise more. They don't need motivation.
But we are often projecting ourselves into an unknown future.
Welcome to How to Be an Adult. This is a podcast created by the practitioners at the Morpheus Clinic for Hypnosis in Toronto, Canada. It's for people just like you who've inadvertently become adults and don't know what to do about it. I'm Luke Chow.
And I'm Pascal Langdale. Now, this is the trail guide to life that your parents never gave you when you reached the age of majority. And we share our ideas and our principles and our approaches in an effort to democratize self-love, self-care, self-compassion.
In this episode, we're going to do our best to work out how to best live with a trauma history. When you've been wounded by other people or the world, and then you have to live with the pain that one lives with after trauma, there are a few responses that people go to. And one response is to just kind of take it out on others. So your boss yells at you, you yell at your wife yells at the kid yells at the cat. Another response is to kind of just hold the pain on the inside and not perpetuate your suffering upon other people. But there is a better alternative to that. And here we'll seek to unravel how one might try to recover from the wounds that have been inflicted upon them and achieve, or at least try to achieve, something called post-traumatic growth.
I was watching a series by a clinician on trauma recently, and he stated that reasonable efforts to come to a conclusion as to who suffers from trauma reached levels of around 75%. So 75% of the population has experienced some form of trauma in their past. And I would suggest that perhaps after COVID, that's actually gone up.
It depends on the threshold you choose for trauma. Mm-hmm. So I do agree, COVID kind of put us in this collective trauma of living in a pandemic and suddenly being scared of our friends, being scared of ourselves if we visit our grandparents. You could also make the argument that the school system traumatizes its people. You could make the argument that living under capitalism traumatizes its people. It depends on the threshold you pick.
Yeah.
I am someone who will not seek to gatekeep trauma. To me, if you self-assess that you've been through trauma, that to me is good enough. Mm. I'll share with our listeners that I actually have a diagnosis of complex PTSD. So PTSD, traditionally defined, is it's kind of like a stab wound to the gut. There are clearly defined incidents that give you trauma, like a natural disaster. Complex trauma is more like the death of a thousand cuts, where one might grow up believing that he or she is not being traumatized simply because there is no stab wound to the gut to find. But the symptoms are similar to if you've gotten that stab wound to the gut. Hypervigilance, for example, a negative self-image. So much of what I share today is first what I've experienced personally, and then what I've shared with my clients, so that I can kind of draw these conclusions about how human beings can do our version of licking our wounds and trying to recover after we've been wounded by the world.
One of the aspects that differs between CPTSD and PTSD, particularly if it happens in your youth and your formative developmental years, you learn strategies to deal with the thousand cuts and you survive. And it's quite possible to reach adulthood and think, well, that's it. These are the rules by which I can live because they worked. But the challenge is that what worked during the period of a thousand cuts may not work when you're trying to be an adult in the world and you start to have relationships and responsibilities, and those same tools don't necessarily apply. You're no longer working to an accurate map.
Well, we can understand that the rescue dog or the rescue cat might have been adapted to an abusive environment. Mm. So cowering all the time, you know, jumping at loud noises, they're adapted to an abusive environment. But once we take the animal and put them in a loving home where they can see for themselves that it's safe, they can venture out, they can make noise, and they don't have to cower. Well, then the animal adapts to its new environment. Now, we human beings are also capable of adapting to our adult environments. So I have seven concise points, just like colors of the rainbow. We can look at the finer grain details and come up with more, but at least at this point in my career and my life, I've ascertained seven main points I want to make for how to cope with trauma. And the first one is to remember that trauma doesn't mean that you're broken, like a shattered iPhone screen. It means you're wounded. It comes from the Greek word for wound, and it's a wounded psyche, of course. It's not a wounded body. But the word wound implies is that you're not at fault, and also that the wound can heal. Mm. And that's very different from a paradigm of brokenness, where perhaps it's your fault that you're broken, and perhaps you're irreparable. So the first main point I absolutely want to make is that if we recall what trauma means, it's a wounded psyche, and wounds heal. Wounds do heal. You might have to apply ample dollops of self-love and self-care to help your emotional wounds heal. But if we keep our mind on healing, then we don't have our minds on the erroneous idea that life could just simply break without later healing.
I would even suggest that it's inevitable that you will attempt to heal your psyche, that drive to heal is as inevitable as life itself, in fact. So in some ways, some of the maladaptive choices that you might be making are an effort still to heal. It's just that they don't really work for you.
Yes.
And so you can't look at the evidence of your behavior and coruscate yourself for them, saying, I shouldn't be doing this, I shouldn't be doing that. It's proof that I'm broken. Quite contrary to that, I would argue that the very fact that you're doing those things at all is actually proof that A, you're alive, and B, you're trying to heal. It's just that you've not been given the right guidance to figure out how.
Exactly. It's like you're asked to climb the mountain on your own, and you know you can do it. But without a guide and having to find your own way, it is a lot harder. And sometimes you might make a misstep compared to if in psychotherapy, for example, or in our work, or just listening to this podcast, you have some guidance in how to climb the mountain of trauma recovery. Mm. This point about being wounded and not broken, which makes healing inevitable, it follows from the fact that we are only correctly categorized as life. So the living animal who had been wounded physically or emotionally, given enough care, can be expected to heal and then be happy and healthy again, right? But the stuffed animal who's wounded cannot heal. We could go in and sew it up and fix it, but let's make this distinction between life versus objects, where life will heal, life will adapt, life will find a way, whether we're talking about a tree with its branches and roots, or whether we're talking about the wolf going back to her den, licking her wounds, or the human being trying to figure out how are they going to climb this mountain of trauma recovery. This aliveness is worth underscoring because the rules for how we treat life are very different from the rules for how we treat things. Where things could be broken, things require us to like tinker with them until they're fixed. Life just requires nourishment. Life has to have its needs met, and then healing follows inevitably. For us human beings, our needs include, well, everything Maslow identified. So love, esteem, respect, on top of the physical needs like safety and food and air and water. As adults, we have to fulfill our own needs. So self-love and self-esteem and self-respect might have to do in a world where others might not give you enough love and esteem and respect, but it fulfills the need. Hmm. It's not just love from another that's valid. Your self-love is valid. It just wasn't underscored enough when you were a child, which is probably why you're listening to this podcast. And I'm here to tell you that your self-love comes from a human being who has a heart, who knows you very, very, very well, and who's going to be with you for the rest of your life. What you have with yourself is a in sickness and in health, till death do you part thing. Even when you feel half alive, you're completely alive. If you perceive yourself as 100% alive, you're perceiving the whole thing. When people feel half alive, that's because they're not looking at their entirety.
Hmm. So the second point is to take guardianship of your own body, which is similar to that phrase, which is, you know, you are life under your own care. You're a mind and a body under your own care.
Absolutely. Because if you forget this fact, then you're completely abandoned some of the time, right? So you're trying to fall asleep at night. If you don't count yourself as life that's yours to care for, if you've not adopted yourself in the way I'm advising, often then you're with your own darkest thoughts. But if you've kind of adopted yourself in a way so that you're guaranteeing you're always going to be there to love you and care for you, and you're never going to betray or abandon yourself, then every night you go to bed with someone you love.
I think in some ways it's, and we've said this before, it's the panacea. It seems to be the foundational and core axiom, if you like, that you have fundamental intrinsic worth and that you are life in your own care, which many other decisions automatically proceed from. So to give you an example, if something triggers a memory, for example, or triggers a feeling, and this feeling is a historical echo of something that is not present, is not real, and is not in the here and now, then if you're treating yourself not as a friend would, if you're treating yourself bad, you're mistreating yourself, you would criticize yourself from those feelings, you would adopt them as being true and valid and not give yourself the grace, shall we say, to even be able to inquire about what that emotion is, where it's come from. To even begin to learn about yourself, you have to start off with a certain level of self-love that says it's worth learning, it's worth taking that time and taking a step back to be able to observe what's going on with compassion.
And what you're talking about is someone who's still kind of adapted to their childhood environment, like the rescue dog who's not yet been adopted.
Yeah.
This is why I'm asking our listeners to adopt themselves in a way to be the guarantors of their own lovability and worthiness and respectability being consistently recognized. If 8 billion people on the planet did this for themselves, the world will be much better off. It's not going to like take someone else's self-esteem if you esteem yourself and, you know, everyone's doing the self-esteem thing correctly. Just like if everyone sleeps well at night, the world's going to be better off. If, you know, everyone has love in their hearts, the world will be better off.
But one of the aspects that I often see about life in your own care is that even that can seem like a huge mountain. And I think it's important to state, even at this point, that even the smallest incremental step that is based on a value of self-care is huge. Even if it's something as small as, you know, drinking a glass of water, that to the outside might be, well, I could drink water all the time. What's the problem with that? You know, to some people, even the smallest steps are huge and should be honored and respected as if it was somebody that had just scaled Everest. You know, it's not a small or negligent thing to be able to make that step sometimes.
Because you're then abiding by the paradigm that your life that's under your care. If you refuse to drink a glass of water just because you're feeling miserable, you're not abiding by the paradigm that your life that's under your care. And every mountain is climbed one foothold at a time. Literally everyone who's ever scaled Mount Everest did it one little step at a time, and it would have been difficult. It was sometimes life-threatening, but this is what the professionals do. This is what those who reach the peak do. They take it one little step at a time. They stay on the slope. And then eventually they're at the peak.
And so what I'm advocating for here is, within that statement, there's a sense of boldness and a sense of forthrightness that sometimes isn't felt, particularly in the early stages. And that, to me, one of the things I'd like to underline is that if your sense of self-worth has been educated into you to such a degree that you find it difficult to treat yourself as life under your own care, to have compassion for yourself, I mean, really difficult, then any step that you take should be celebrated and not a subject for shame or, again, being pointed out and saying, yeah, you're broken because this is all you can do. Everybody else seems to be able to do it, but you can't. You find it difficult. And that becomes, again, another avenue for that old voice of the worst voices that ever spoke to you, you know, to come back in. And so I wanted to point out that even those first steps in some ways should garner respect and awards, because they are, even if they may appear small, they are still big to you. And that's really, only you get to be the arbiter and the moral authority on the kind of steps that are possible for you at any given time. And so if it's a small step, for other people, it could be, like, there's people that you and I know that find it difficult to get out of bed, you know.
I've been there.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that just getting out of bed could be a huge deal. And as soon as you've done that, as soon as you've made the choice, today I'm going to get out of bed because I am a life under my own care and I have worth. The moment you make that one first decision, then it shows you have a choice. It shows that you have agency. It shows that you are able to make a positive choice and redirect your thoughts to a positive behavior. And if you know you can do it once, then you can do it twice. And then eventually these steps become bigger and bigger and can be exponential. And because of this, we can say that sometimes we can see quite rapid change as a result, because it's not necessarily, you know, 10 years of therapy that's that's required, but it's this reinforcement of the steps based on a foundation of self-worth.
Many people, I think, who are lying in bed, not doing anything, and again, I've been there. I've been there more than once in my life. It's because they're waiting for a feeling that they can go out of bed and nothing bad will happen and they can handle life before they do it. And that's the wrong order of things. Mm-hmm. What you're advocating for is to take the action one way or another and expect that the feelings follow from actions. Mm. Again, I've been there. This way works. Mm. In fact, with any difficult enough endeavor, you don't want to just wait passively for the right feeling to come along before you do the thing, whether it's getting out of bed when you have depression, or whether it's writing the great American novel, or whether it's recording your first album. Just starting to take the actions produces the feelings which follow after the actions. It would be the wrong order of things to wait for the right feelings to strike if you're already depressed and bad. Mm-hmm.
So what we're talking about, so far as self-care, we're moving into those physical needs. So drinking water, exercise. But what is the correct or the most beneficial attitude to your body, a body that's been traumatized?
So that ties into our third point, which is that we have to fulfill all of our physical needs. Now, I have to tell a lot of people to take a deep breath, because they're not even fulfilling the basic physical need of breathing deeply enough. Now, I know where this comes from. It comes from the feeling that it's not safe to take a breath. I know that's the feeling, but when you take the small action of asking your body for a deeper breath, and then you take a deeper breath, and you see no bad thing happens. There's no, like, velociraptor around the corner ready to eat you. Then you can breathe deeply, your body gets that need fulfilled, and your body also gets, through the mind-body link, the signal that it's safe to breathe. Now, for someone who's dealing with post-traumatic stress, it's a very helpful signal to give your body that it's safe to breathe. It's safe to breathe deeply, and therefore it's safe to relax. It's safe to even let your guard down at least a little bit, and then see if it's safe to let your guard down a little bit further. It's not too basic to talk about drinking some water, taking a deep enough breath, given how many people fail to fulfill even these most basic of needs that a human being has. Other physical needs that often people neglect because they're going through some stuff are the need for sleep, which is an entitlement. It's not a nice to have when you finally get around to it. Or the need to eat good enough food, where, you know, feeling miserable is no excuse to feed yourself junk that you wouldn't give to anyone you love. So the action of eating fruits and vegetables underscores that you're adopting a new paradigm where you are indeed life that's under your care, and you've indeed adopted yourself, and you would hold yourself to the same standards you would hold yourself to if you were responsible for a cat, a dog, maybe even a houseplant. The houseplant gets enough water, not too much, but enough water, rather than a bottle of wine.
Yeah, and there's an aspect of that which is, like a dog, for instance, you take a dog for a walk, you would exercise the dog. The dog needs exercise. So that, again, you could be consistent if you do that for a dog that you would do that for yourself. The same with medical care or water, food. You know, I remember reading, I can't remember where it was now, about how they did a sort of a survey of how much money and how much attention were paid towards pets compared to the owners on themselves. And it was like a huge difference. It's like more money and more attention was being paid towards their own pets than was being paid to themselves, which is really quite inconsistent, you know, that's one way of putting it.
People think they need motivation to drink less, to stop smoking, to exercise more. They don't need motivation to fulfill these basic needs for their pet, cat, or dog. The missing piece of the puzzle for how we treat ourselves is love. Mm. So knowing you've got to walk the dog is not enough. You've got to know that and love the dog too, and then you're walking the dog. So knowing what you have to eat or how to exercise and use the machines at the gym isn't enough unless you have that piece of the puzzle, which is self-love.
And even if it's not a question of getting a gym membership and working out how to use the machines, if you're approaching exercise from the point of view, which is not that I want to get necessarily buff and and, you know, yeah, and sculpted, but that it's important to exercise because I spend most of my time at a desk. It's important to exercise because it's good for my mental health. Just as it's to equal to say, it's good that I sleep because when I'm tired, that negative voice gets louder and I find it harder to turn the volume down on it. I believe more of the dark imaginings when I'm tired. And I have less energy that I can bring to preparing good food. There's some sort of key aspects that even in the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, perhaps there's sort of sleep might be right up there at the top.
And that's under-recognized, that sleep is a physical need, but it is a physical need. Even if you don't get these kinds of outcomes, right? So even if your inner critic is still strong, though you've slept well, that's not a failure. Mm. Because sleep in itself is intrinsically valuable. Mm-hmm. As long as you can raise the question of, should I treat myself well or poorly today? The answer is, treat yourself as human life that is under your care.
And one thought that you can add to that is that, generally speaking, you don't regret it. I can't think of a time that you regret treating yourself well with compassion and with a sense of self-worth.
Independently of the outcomes.
Yes, exactly.
So among our basic needs is to have a safe person to physically share ourselves with. Mm. And I'm going to count animals as people for the purposes of this discussion, because for all intents and purposes, they are. They have hearts, they have emotions, they see us, and they're there for us, and they don't judge us. So when we're touch-starved, mm-hmm, right, it's almost like we're dehydrated or we're malnourished. It will be harder to love yourself. It will be harder to fulfill your obligations to society if you're touch-starved. Mm. Like when my cat died, I've talked about this in prior episodes. When my cat died, I had a very hard time sleeping for quite some time. The presence of that animal fulfilled my need to receive touch. Mm-hmm. To have my physical presence recognized as worthy or valid enough to cuddle up next to. Mm. And I sort of see this crisis in our society where, especially young men, right? Unless you have a cat or a dog, you might have nobody to do that with, to cuddle with, to have your physical presence validated. So of course you feel empty in your heart. Of course it's like you're malnourished. When you have a trauma history, it is harder to date or to, I guess, be recognized as normal.
Right. If you're with 75% of others, then you are normal. Well, you're not the exception.
Yeah. But that's under-recognized until we say it on a podcast like this. That, you know, you're definitely not the only person in the city that you're in who is touch-starved and who just wishes they could find someone else. Even if you just, like, met, your needs are... You don't even have to have sex. Mm. That need is valid. I mean, sex is kind of like an option for a lot of people. But to kind of be hugged or held... Or to have like a cat mash their belly into your face because that's what they do. That physical validation of your actual presence in this material world made of atoms and molecules seems to make a difference, and especially for those with a trauma history.
Yeah.
The fourth point that I want to make is that we're not just rational beings. We're also moral beings. And in the prior episode, we talked about why we need to account for morality, even in this world where the M word seems quaint and outdated. Now, a lot of the problems that I see in my clients are problems of demoralization. If they're connected with a moral center, they're willing to say no thank you to other people's bad ideas, right? If they're connected with their moral center, then of course they treat themselves as a living human being that they're responsible for. If they're connected with their moral center, then the long dark nights become easier to bear. If you're disconnected with your moral center, other people's bad ideas might end up being weighed equally to good ideas in your mind. So someone else's cruelty, you might actually take as valid if you're out of touch with your moral center. So,
and I think part of the challenge there is that if you have CPTSD because your developmental period has been traumatized or traumatizing, is that as a child you don't have the experience or the wisdom to have a developed, shall we say, moral center. You look to your peers, you look to your parents and your peers to say, well, what is it that I should guide myself with? Mm-hmm. And if your parents are saying, for instance, if you're having an emotion and your parents are gaslighting you, then you're being told that you shouldn't trust your emotions, for example. And that's, you could say, well, as an adult, you have to observe your emotions, see them as signals and trust them as good signals of something. You don't have to see, treat them like lenses that you need to see the world through. But still, this is an example of how trauma can put you in a situation where you have to make your morals. You have to figure out what they are because you weren't told them at all. And you were actually instructed in a very different moral that was about somebody else's needs and desires and proclivities, if you like, and not honoring yours.
I'm going to make an interesting argument that human beings are not the only moral animals. I'm going to make the argument that the animals who we can kind of interact with in a friendly way or play with in a friendly way have a kind of instinctive morality that we human beings as mammals can kind of tap into too. So for example, let's say that I'm respectfully playing with a cat and the cat's got its claws, right? The cat's morality doesn't permit them to extend their claws for me, who is respectfully playing with the cat and honoring their boundaries. But then if I'm just a total jerk, and then I like grab the cat in a way they don't like, the claws come out. Now, we human beings, we don't use claws, we don't use teeth to set boundaries. We're supposed to use our words. Words like no, words like not a chance, and even words like go away and its ruder variations. Often, if we're not permitted to use these kinds of words, or if we have this kind of false morality that we're good if we say yes and we're bad if we say no, then that's one of the ways we become out of touch with our moral centers. I mean, cats should have their claws, not because they're going to scratch you, but because on a long enough timeline, they're going to come across some jerk who needs to be told off. I guess one of the points we're trying to make here is you don't have to become a moral philosopher in order to get in touch with your moral center. Trauma kind of disconnects you with your moral center. So if you kind of feel your feelings again and recognize that sometimes the parents are wrong, sometimes the authorities are wrong, and you feel your feelings, including anger, then you don't have to become a moral philosopher. You're connected with something much deeper than what you might read in a book.
So now we're coming to point five, which is believing in your own senses. That's something which is surprisingly difficult for many of us, in the sense that we are often projecting ourselves into an unknown future, or we're coruscating ourselves or feeling an echo and judging the world according to something that's past and gone. I'll bring up the example again of echoes of emotions or triggered emotions that put your body back into a state that it was. Because, of course, the limbic system has no idea about time. As far as the limbic system is concerned, you're back there. It doesn't have a perception of time the way the cortex does, right? But what that can mean is that you feel that, you believe that to be the truth about now. You feel it to be the truth now. Whereas that's a signal. It's not 2020 vision. And so a lot of the things about grounding, for example, are trying to pull you back into the present, into the here and now. And that means guiding yourself with the evidence of your eyes and your ears and over what is accurate, over what is under your control. I think that's probably one more that I'd add.
The incredible thing is, for a cat to be able to bring down like a moth or like a wild bird, for example, the cat's got to be very much in its senses. It's not imagining what it's going to do in the future when it finally catches a bird. It's not remembering the last five birds it's caught. We human beings, we have the capacity to be in our senses. We also have the capacity to ignore our senses and either flash back to the past or imagine ourselves at some point in the future. I think part of the reason so many of us neglect the evidence of our senses is that we're gaslit when we're young. George Orwell, of course, wrote the very insightful book 1984. And one of the lines, just from memory, is the first and final command of the party is to disbelieve the evidence of your own eyes. And that's, of course, an authoritarian control tactic. There are many households that have employed this authoritarian control tactic. And then one doesn't believe the evidence of their senses. They don't believe what they see, what they hear, what they experience. They don't believe that any of it is valid. So where do they go to instead? Past or future, memory or imagination? And this episode, of course, is about living well with trauma. So it's especially when you've experienced trauma and then your experiences have been ignored or denied, that's where your sensory perception becomes undermined. You start questioning, can I believe my own eyes? Is that authority figure right? Did it really not happen? And our listeners, if you're listening this far into the episode, you've probably gone down spirals like that that lead to no satisfying conclusions. I can tell you the lifeline out of that spiral is to be very well grounded in your senses. So to see what you see and believe it, and feel what you feel and believe it, and hear what you hear and believe it. So grounding, as you mentioned, Pascal, you're basically grounding yourself again in the here and the now. It's true that senses are imperfect as a guide to reality, but your senses are a whole lot better as a guide to reality than either childhood memories or the imagination of potential futures, most of which don't actually materialize before you. Another way out of having been gaslit is to recognize who knows what. Because if you are present for whatever is claimed, and the other person was not, if you saw with your eyes and they're just speculating, you're the person with knowledge. You're the person with empirical knowledge. So it doesn't matter if the other person's older than you, or it doesn't matter if that person has a position of authority over you. It's important to recognize who knows what. And when it comes to matters pertaining to you specifically as an individual, you are definitely the person who knows the most. So anytime someone says to you, you're crazy, you're making stuff up, these are very overt forms of gaslighting, of course, but those kinds of statements, if taken seriously, would take you out of this concrete reality we exist in and into potentially endless spirals inside your own head. The sixth point I want to make about how we live well despite trauma is to immerse ourselves in physically immersive experiences or sensations. So for example, taking a hot bath is going to help, and it's because it brings you into the here and the now. You're not remembering the bath you took 2 weeks ago.
Or a cold
you're
bath.
You're feeling the bath, or a cold bath, or a cold shower. Whatever floats your boat, if it gives you sensory stimulation, then it brings you to the here and the now. The situation you want to avoid is lying in bed with your eyes closed, thinking of things and ruminating and imagining possibilities and thinking could have, should have, would have.
And getting yourself into a healthy situation. So you're talking about doing things that engage you and take you out of the negative rumination, for example.
Yes. So holding an acoustic guitar, fingering a chord, and even just strumming the chord. Now you're connecting your body and the motion with a sound you hear through a different sense. Mm-hmm. Something as simple as that. I'm assuming the guitar's in tune, by the way. Something as simple as that asserts that you're not just subject to the world. Mm. You're a subject in this world. You're supposed to act upon the world to make it a little bit better, even if you're just moving sound waves through this instrument.
And to a degree, it doesn't really matter what that is. It's just that that first step of doing almost anything mm-hmm. is likely to put you on track to getting you out of your head so much.
Yes. And those who don't have so much of a trauma history, they might not have to go out of their own way to give themselves this kind of antidote to ground themselves, right? If you're thinking about having to ground yourself over and over and over again, you might have a trauma history. I just want to say that, you know, for those of you who are listening, you have no idea what I'm talking about. it's probably because you don't have too much of a trauma history. So you can be in the here and the now, and it doesn't take much great effort. And you don't really flash back to past memories or ruminate about the past. And you also don't really try to figure out the infinite branching paths that could go forward in time. And you could actually like enjoy a sunny day. Mm. Our goal with this episode is to get our listeners as close to that ideal as possible.
Yeah.
I want to account for experiences that go beyond just physically grounding yourself in the world. I want to account for transcendent experiences, like really good music, good storytelling, even if the storytelling is through a screen and speakers, as it often is in this modern world, time spent in beautiful natural scenes, walking through an art gallery. When you are witnessing something that goes beyond just your pain or just one individual's pain, when you're witnessing something that kind of speaks to a transcendent human experience, this is another way beyond just the physical and the sensory to be in the here and the now. So when you're watching a movie, you're not really doing anything. You're not creating in this world as I've advocated for. But watching a really good movie, here's what's happening. The filmmakers reached deeply into their humanity to look at some aspect of that humanity, which you share too. And then through their craft, they've brought forth into this world an expression of their collective humanity so that now you can recognize your own pain as part of a shared human experience and not just individual to you. Or maybe you'll recognize your anger to be part of a shared human experience and not a problem with you individually.
Or maybe it opens up the possibility for joy, which has been kept hidden from you or that you've hidden from yourself.
Yes. The kind of catharsis that follows from witnessing tragedy, right? It's not just for the ancient Greeks. They were human beings like us. You know, dark films, so-called depressing films, even films that are not that joyful, not that happy, have a lot of use in this world because now you know when you witness such things that, your pain's not just yours and other people are suffering too and you are not alone.
Does the idea of transcendence or transcending experiences go beyond the human? So would you say awe would be going even further into, for instance, extending your sense of self in respect to the truly transcendent?
So gazing up at the stars.
Yeah, or
going forests, to the Grand Canyon.
Massive churches with vaulted ceilings designed to create that sensation.
Yes, and I don't really have like the I'm not really like an aesthetic philosopher, so I don't really have the vocabulary to talk about those kinds of experiences, but awe I think is a good word. Now, an interesting thing I've noticed among some of my clients with a fear of heights is that what they're actually experiencing is uncontained awe.
Hmm.
And once we describe their fear of heights as a sense of awe that they're capable of containing, then they don't feel so overwhelmed. Then they feel like their feet can be on the ground and they're not going to be overwhelmed and like jump into the Grand Canyon or something as one often imagines. So yeah, I think that we should make room for a sense of awe. And I also think that a human mind can, in a way, contain it, even if we can't comprehend it.
In many aspects, those things that do create awe are things that are extraordinary in their presence outside the human sense of time and space, but are constrained enough so that we can perceive them. So if you look up at trees, for example, the trees are present. It's not empty space. It's describing, it's actually limiting space. But the multiplicity of light, the leaves, these are all constraints, but they're constraints enough that implicate something which is transcendent. The same with a church roof or a mosque roof. They're very vaulted. They're vaulted because if it was the open sky and you couldn't see anything obstructing the sky, it would just be the sky. It would be unfathomable. You wouldn't feel that sense of awe necessarily. Mm-hmm. But you bring a roof in and suddenly you sense the great feeling of space as mm-hmm. you look up. If you look at stars, for example, you don't get necessarily the same feeling when you're looking at a big blue sky. I mean, you could do, don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. but the stars actually create a canopy that brings in, constrains the sense of the incredible depths of space and time and distance that is implied by the stars. And that's why that sense of awe. I think I've seen studies where awe is considered, again, one of those things that can really bring you out of your rumination on negative self, if that makes mm-hmm. sense.
Any experience that is more interesting when your attention's out there
yeah.
compared to lying in bed with what you think is the most interesting thing you could think of, it's going to help you. And another experience that kind of you would have to immerse yourself into to get the most out of is trauma therapy. So EMDR, for example. And, you know, I'm not actually a trauma therapist. Most of what I know about trauma comes from personal experience, which is why I think I can kind of describe the experience from the inside. But I have gone through trauma therapy, and the experience of immersing yourself in your feelings while there's a lifeline, namely your therapist, to pull you out if they have to, that can be helpful within those parameters.
So point 7 is pretty succinct. Keep away from harms.
Yes. So many of us gravitate to alcohol, to drugs, to careless sex, to careless spending as a trauma response because it makes us feel at least okay, if not good. It makes us feel okay temporarily. So that's why we have to make this 7th point, that because you have a trauma history, you might not respond to stress the way that someone with a better upbringing does. You might gravitate to these kinds of coping mechanisms. We want you to use one of the other coping mechanisms that we've been talking about. So you're not wasting your time by going out to the countryside, finding a hill and looking up at the stars for 12 hours until the sun comes up. You now have our professional encouragement and validation to do precisely that. The point is to stay away from these kinds of temporary band-aid fixes that I know you've been trying, and to try something different. And social media is another one of those mindlessly engaging activities that makes you feel okay, but not actually good.
Well, this is interesting in the sense that, well, we've already stated that almost all behavior, including maladaptive behavior, including, for instance, drink or smoking, whatever it is still an attempt to heal. It's just maladaptive. What you're trying to do is trying to heal yourself from that pain. You're trying to avoid it. You're trying to overwhelm it. You're trying to get your mind off it, take a break from it. The urge, if you like, is not wrong because there's a side of you which is trying to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. It's just that you're going in a direction that ultimately creates harm. And one of the thoughts that brings me to is that the repercussions of doing something which does you harm is sort of often quite deferred. Right? So you can get a drinking habit and it might be years until it really actually affects your life to the degree that it's appalling. You know, it is possible it could get there. But at first it's not that. Right. So it's not only that it's a short-term solution, it's one where the cost is somewhat deferred. Mm-hmm. And what are you deferring the cost for? What are you doing it for? And part of that is because there is immense discomfort somewhere. It's the wound, if you like, is being felt in one way or another. And I think that part of recovering from trauma and actually growing from trauma is learning how to sit and be okay with those sensations and be the adult to yourself, allowing yourself the time to not just go knee-jerk reaction, must escape,
yep.
and instead have an approach which is, what? How can I treat myself well, bearing in mind I feel this bad, bearing in yep. mind that this makes me want to run for the hills, bearing in mind this makes me want to hit myself over the head so that I don't have to think or feel this way. It can be awful, but coming to understand that you have the ability to sit with those emotions without the repercussion of some diversion or some just doing that is an extraordinary act.
One of the points we made at the beginning is that one in adulthood should adopt themselves. So if you have a kid and they're plainly upset, are you going to give them a cigarette? Are you going to give them some whiskey? Are you going to advise them to go spend their allowance on stuff they don't need? Probably you're going to do just what you said. Sit with them. Be with them. Help them recognize that things are still going to be okay, though they feel all of this awful feeling. Now, we can teach a child how to do that. So I have complete faith in you as an adult that you can learn how to do that too. And let's also account under this point for people who are harmful because of the ideas or the worldview that they espouse. The so-called toxic people with toxic ideologies that don't even recognize you're a living human being with an independence of thought and morality, for example. Keep them away from yourself, just like you keep them away from anyone else you love. Or at least if they're around, recognize in your own head and heart how completely wrong they can be. Because sometimes the other person is the jerk. And it's not automatically you, even if your trauma response says it's automatically you.
And this goes back to the evidence of your eyes and ears. If you do teach yourself to go with what you can perceive in the here and now, that you will pick out the psychopaths, you'll pick out the narcissists, you'll pick out the dark triads. And instead of continuing the belief that somehow you wouldn't be able to tell that and you must be wrong and that this other person must be right, you can develop a skill in being able to identify who is not good to be around.
It comes with being connected with your moral center too, because the dark triad personalities, you know, are famously immoral.
And often amoral. Charming and engaging and many things.
Which just puts salt in the wounds and, you know, kicks someone when they're down. So when you're connected with your moral center and then you're believing the evidence of your senses, it's so much easier to pick out these so-called toxic personalities.
And then you get to say, nope, no thank you.
Exactly. As an expression of your morality. So those are our seven main pointers for how to climb the mountain of trauma recovery so that you don't have to feel like you're doing it on your own or that you're only left with the scarce tools that your childhood gave to you. If you've already stumbled across these methods on your own, you know you're not crazy, you know you're not alone, and at least we hope to have underscored that you are doing the right things. Our intent with this, of course, is to foster post-traumatic growth, which is a phenomenon that's becoming increasingly recognized, where it's not just post-traumatic stress that people experience. There is a response called post-traumatic growth. And even though it's kind of a new field of study, I believe that when you're fulfilling all your needs, the physical needs, the social needs, the love needs, that's where, like rehabilitating the rescue dog, you have a good chance of post-traumatic growth. Thank you again for listening and all the way to the end. Pascal and I are available for hire through the Morpheus Clinic for Hypnosis in Toronto, Canada. We do free consultations and treatment plans for our private clients. And recently, we've also started doing free shared hypnosis sessions twice a month. So you don't even have to pay us anything to come into our space and listen to more of this way of thinking. Please take us up on that offer, and please tell your friends too. Don't be put off too much by the H word. That's just a way to listen closely so that we can act as practical philosophers and think on your behalf and help you adopt these ideas as your own.
And if you like these ideas and you want to hear more, then please click subscribe at Morpheus Hypnosis on YouTube. Of course, wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Carrier Pigeon, whatever, we'll be there. So we look forward to doing this again in another few weeks or so.
See you then.